Following along a series of lectures that have taken place on the U of I campus for a long time. It's a series called the Friday Forum, and it is jointly sponsored by the Illinois Disciples Foundation, the McKinley Foundation, the University Y, and the Wesley Foundation. It's a series of noontime talks that are all organized around a single topic, and they have titled the series this spring, From Frankenstein to Sliced Bread, Empowering the Human in a Technological Society. And we hope to be talking with a number of the speakers who will be here in the series. We have been following the series along for years and years because we think that it raised some interesting questions, and we wanted to make it possible for people outside of Champaign-Urbana to hear from some of these speakers. And the lead speaker for the series is with us this morning. Kristen Dawkins is Director of Trade and Agricultural Programs at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, which is based in Minneapolis. And she will be talking at the forum and with us today about patenting of life and some of the questions that are raised, ethical, legal, economic, by the move to put patents on growing things, not only plants, but also animals. And some people ask the question, once we have done that, can it be very long until we start thinking about patenting people or parts of people? Those are the questions that we'll try to get into this morning. And as we do that, you're certainly free, you people who are listening are free to call in. Maybe you'll have some questions, comments. That's welcome. All we ask of listeners is that they are brief when they call so that we can accommodate as many different callers as possible and keep things moving along. But anybody is welcome to participate. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point you want to join the conversation, you can do that. There's a little bit more in the way of background on our guest. Kristen Dawkins, in her own work, has focused on the issues of food security, environmental impacts, and also intellectual property rights. She travels quite a lot in representing the Institute at international negotiations and conferences. She came to the Institute from the Harvard Law School program on negotiation, where she was a senior writer for their international publication Consensus. From 1973 to 1989, she worked in community development and related public policy areas in Philadelphia. She's a graduate of MIT, where she has a master's degree in city planning. And we're glad to have you here with us. Thank you.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
You were, I know you and a number of other people kind of put together a report looking at some of the issues involved in the ownership of life. And right at the beginning, some of the authors put it, I think, rather nicely, and maybe that gives us a place to start. It's a pretty good turn of phrase or a pretty good idea where they suggest that for every era, for every generation, there is both a defining political crisis and also has a sort of a defining technological revolution. And the authors suggest that at our time, it's one and the same. It's the same thing, the defining crisis, the technological revolution, and that is this whole business of the possibility of patenting, having patents on living things.
Yes, and the very close relationship to genetic engineering.
Right, yeah. Let's talk about that. I mean, how, I guess, you know, one can easily see how that is a technological innovation, but how is that a political crisis?
Well, it depends on whether you are in some way making your living off of natural resources at this time. Those people who are finding that they're losing their control over their own livelihoods, and that would apply to farmers in southern Illinois or anywhere else in the United States, just as it applies to peasant farmers in other parts of the world or those Indian tribes that still rely on the forests and hunting and gathering for their living. It's the conversion of these natural resources that have, since time immemorial, kept humanity alive and also been readily available to those communities that depend on them. Are being privatized. They are being taken out of those communities manipulated in the laboratory, assigned a patent, and then they become the private property of most often a corporation, in some cases a university. And then the people who have relied on it all of these centuries oftentimes end up having to pay royalties if they wish to continue using these materials.
We have, I think, had this, I'm not sure for how long, but for a significant amount of time, we've had this idea of the patent, and generally have accepted this notion that if an individual invents something, that then he or she should be able to profit from their work, at least for some period of time. Then eventually we get this idea that it moves into the public domain. But the idea is that if there's not going to be any innovation unless inventors and entrepreneurs can feel that they'll get something out of it, and that we have come to accept that that idea with mechanical devices, with ideas, for a long time, for as long as there has been sort of modern plant breeding. I guess we've also accepted the idea that when it comes to hybrid plants, we should do the same sorts of thing. So what's the problem with taking the idea of patents and extending that to a soybean plant, a mouse, human cells? And why is that really different from an automobile, from a telephone, from a computer?
Well, there are, I think, huge moral issues and religious issues, if you will, around whether life itself can be not only owned and controlled by some entity, but also whether or not it is really something that can be invented, which is the basic criteria of a patent. Now, obviously, the effort that goes into genetic engineering or some of the more sophisticated breeding does require a good deal of innovation and work and research, but does that mean that then that plant, which actually was innovated upon by tens of thousands of years of farmers over history, even though they didn't have laboratories and modern science, they did indeed carefully select the seeds that worked best in the particular soil or climate conditions of their farm. And there's been a tremendous amount of plant breeding going on well before modern science. So how can we say which generation of innovators in plant materials actually deserve the monopoly right to control it? And there's a whole big political negotiation going on internationally about the concept of benefit sharing. At least if it's going to be signed a patent or privatized according to any range of intellectual property right systems, then how should the benefits, the profits, the royalties from controlling that monopoly be shared with the prior generations or other communities in this planet who have also played their role in the development of this material? The polio vaccine, which Jonas Salk invented only a couple of decades ago, we can all sort of remember that coming along into the stream of science. Actually, he refused a patent on the vaccine. He said it was of far too much importance to society to make it broadly and publicly available, and he declined to take out that exclusive monopoly.
Well, I guess we sooner or later we get to the question: if we if we didn't grant patent rights on medications, on food plants, on technological developments that improve life, then would they still happen? And is this not sort of the engine of innovation that we're saying that because we know that bringing new products to market can take a long time, can take a lot of work, can take a lot of money, and if we take the profit motive out of it, then are we going to discourage people from inventing new things?
This is indeed highly debated, and the corporations quite naturally argue, just as you have, that indeed they wouldn't have the incentive to innovate, and then we would not advance in science. We wouldn't invent the cure for AIDS. We wouldn't invent the cure for cancer if their right to patent the innovations along the way is eliminated. But there's a growing body of scientists who are often in the public sector, in the university systems sometimes, who argue that, to the contrary, the patents are actually inhibiting their ability to find such a cure, because they are often instructed by their bosses to not share their research, to not publish, to not go to conferences and tell others who might be working in the same field what they may have discovered in their most recent experiments, because they want to be first in line at the patent office when they do get something that might be commercial. Tendency not to publish and not to share that research then means that they're really working in isolation and they can't benefit from each other's discoveries. And together then, in a sooner way, find those real cures.
Well, let me reintroduce our guest here for this first part of Focus 580. We're talking with Kristen Dawkins. She's Director of Trade and Agricultural, Director of the Trade and Agriculture Program at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy in Minneapolis. And she is here in Champaign-Urbana to speak as part of the Friday Forum series, talking about the ownership of life and the issue of patenting living things. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Maybe we could talk about some, are there some particularly problematic case studies maybe that we could talk about that you would think maybe might illustrate some of the points that we're talking about here, particularly why it is that maybe we would want to think carefully about granting patents on not only plants but products that are somehow one way or another derived from human beings?
Sure. I guess one example of a more extreme case is what we call a sweeping patent. And that is when a company or research institute claims in their patent application that not only do they want the exclusive rights to the particular commercial product that they've discovered at that time, but also to the entire species of soybeans or cotton. For example, the patent on Dolly, the cloned sheep, by this Scottish institute, the Roslin Institute, actually applies to all cloned mammals. And indeed, they just announced this week that they now are planning to clone human embryos, and they're looking for partners, financial or other scientists who would like to work with them in that. So as you opened this conversation, I mean, we are already at the point where the cloning and the patenting of humans has actually been filed and approved.
That does seem to be certainly a potential problem or something worth arguing about, this tendency of companies to look at some sort of intellectual territory that might, they might not even know if that's going to yield anything, but it might have that potential. So they're already staking out territory that is, in a sense, unexplored. We don't really know what's there, but they're saying, speaking figuratively, everything inside this area here is ours. Whatever we happen to find there, it belongs to us. And that actually is something that courts that rule on these matters have been sympathetic to, even if the desire to patent something isn't really specific. We're sort of in a vague sort of way saying, well, if you do find something, then go ahead and you can do that.
Yeah, according to U.S. patent law, you're supposed to be able to prove not only that it was an innovation, a market innovation, but also that it is that it has utility, that there's a known use for this. But there really isn't any relationship between the patent office and the court system. Perhaps there ought to be. But these decisions really are made by the patent office all by itself, with very little oversight by other entities in the judicial system. The patent office is being flooded with applications for various innovations in genetic engineering, including the simply computer-generated gene sequences that have no known utility whatsoever, and the computers are just running 24 hours a day generating different permutations of those four characters that make up DNA, and then they're filing for patents hoping that someday they will discover that some subset of those computer-generated lists of digits will be something that they can commercialize. But it's kind of like the difference between, let's say, owning a lake, which we wouldn't argue with. We don't differ with private property and people's rights to have some control over what is their own. But it's the difference between owning a lake and owning the formula for H2O. If somebody files and gets a patent on H2O, or as I said earlier, all mammals or all soybeans, then no other entity can do work in that field without permission and paying a royalty. So that would apply to all water throughout the planet, more or less the distinction that we try to draw here. Hmm.
But you're also making the argument, and I think some other people would make the argument, that if you, and here's where it sort of gets more complicated, if you could take that H2O and make some kind of a modification to it that would make it better than regular water, something that did not occur in nature, that, you know, why shouldn't I be able to patent my improved water, even though I didn't really invent water in the first place, and it was everywhere, and in a sense it belongs to everybody. But I made a change that made it better, so, you know, why shouldn't I be able to profit from enhancing nature, improving upon nature?
Yeah, I think that that's a legitimate distinction as well, and would imply then that these sweeping patents that I've described would not be part of a contemporary patent system. We would need to legislate some things to exclude that. Also, it would, what you're proposing would exclude the tendency that is very common nowadays around what's called biopiracy or bioprospecting, by which explorers, botanists, or anthropologists, or what have you, usually on contract with, again, a major institution, corporation, university, go exploring in some of the wilderness areas in the tropics more often than not because of the genetic diversity there, and find useful plants. They talk to the local people, or they do just experiments and bring back in their pockets, oftentimes illegally, samples of this genetic material. And then in the laboratory, they simply move one gene around. It doesn't necessarily change the plant, at least not that they're able to identify or put into their patent application, but it nonetheless then gives them the right to, in U.S. law, be awarded the patent. And of course, the people and the governments of some of the countries where this genetic material is being stolen from, as they regard it, are objecting, and this has become a huge international political issue, the whole question of biopiracy. So what you propose would also, I think, eliminate that whole problem area of the law. So then we're just talking about an improved H2O. One last point on this question. I think the issue of whether H2O water is a living thing or not needs to be considered. I believe a lot of indigenous peoples would say water is a living thing, but let's sort of go with our normal Western science and say that it's not a living creature. It's not a form of life itself, although it's obviously a big component. In this case, I think ethicists might argue that it would be okay to patent the improved formula for water, but that's quite different than patenting and privatizing a living thing, a living creature, a species. These are on the ethical side of the debate that I'm raising this question.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple callers to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. And let me give you the number again. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We have our first caller here in Champaign County, and they are on line number one.
I have a couple of points, but your discussion about a patentable form of water reminds me of Kurt Vonnegut's excuse me, the idea of Ice Nine, which is sort of emblematic for the whole argument, the idea that a new form of water is developed and it's useful in some ways, but then it sort of catalyzes a reaction around the world and turns everything into this new form, all the water in the world, to a new form of water, which is solid and not very alive. But anyway, that's roughly the storyline. It's sort of emblematic for the whole argument about the idea of a catalytic chance. A couple of days ago, Focus hosted a fellow who had, I think, a Monsanto endowed chair somewhere. But the one thing I took away from his interview was that he was asserting that academics are so out of the loop now. There's so much research going on at the corporate level that it's all an academic can do is just to keep up with what the research that's coming out of corporations, and of course that has the proprietary idea and the secrecy that's involved, so they only publish what they feel is already common knowledge anyway. So the so-called groundbreaking stuff is not even available, and who knows what they're actually doing. And it's not subject to the usual idea of science and the peer review, et cetera, et cetera. But I have one other point, and then I'll hang up and listen. And that's I just recently heard that one of the things that has to do with who is deciding what will be patentable and who decides what changes are made. Soybeans are a good source of linolenic acid, which is an essential fatty acid that we don't make ourselves. It's also susceptible to spoilage. So one of the things that corporations and factory farm model sorts of people are thinking of doing is breeding a soybean that has less linolenic acid, and then it won't spoil. However, it doesn't have the health properties that a normal soybean does. So what's the point of eating if you're not getting the effects? And if the corporate interests are deciding, well, we want shelf life as opposed to healthy food, which that's also quite emblematic for what's going on as well. So it leads to a critique of the entire industrial model for agriculture, I would guess. But I'll thank you and for your work and listen, and hope to hear some of your talk, which will be rebroadcast next Monday on a local community radio station, by the way.
And what station would that be?
I think it's, let's see, WFT 90.1 FM.
Good.
Thanks.
Okay, sure thing. Do you want to respond to some of the points the caller made?
Sure, those are excellent points, and I hope he recovers from his little catch in the throat there. There are colds, I think, are endemic. I have one myself. Sorry about that. Those are all incredibly good points. There is indeed a tendency not to fund more public interest research and to put a lot more of both federal as well as, of course, private research money into those things that are likelier to get the patent and have immediately very broad commercial applications. That means that they're investing in research on very rare and unusual diseases as opposed to, let's say, research on curing the common cold. And also, there's, as he mentioned, the Vonnegut story, there's indeed a tendency once the patent has been achieved to then do all your marketing for that one product. And so you get enhanced. We've already got a problem with monocultural production systems, and we know very well that this causes a lot of problems. For example, in Minnesota and the prairie states, we've got the northern prairie states, we've got this wheat rust that we just can't deal with that's wiping out a good portion of our wheat crop every year because the monoculture allows this monocultural pest to thrive. But then there are other, food security issues, other environmental issues. There's just a whole lot of issues around monocultural production systems. And his comment also about the commercial tendency to deal with shelf life as opposed to really improving nutritional issues. We hear a lot in the propaganda, the advertising, about how this is going to feed the world or, you know, improve nutrition. And I guess that may be around the corner in some of the new research that's coming out. But if you look at those commercial products that we have right now, there's very little out there that, in fact, none that really are of a benefit to human health. To the contrary, the Roundup Ready products, the BT resistant products, and the RBGH in the milk products, I mean, all these, the Flavor Saver tomato, these examples that we know are in the market today, none of them really are an improvement in nutritional or health, human health advantages.
We're about midway through this part of Focus, and
kind of address this, but David, in your argument, you talked a lot about improving on different, like improving on water was the example. Hmm. But I guess that's my big question, is when we can decide what an improvement is. And I guess I think that Monsanto, in their quest for improving the soybean or corn seed or whatever, I think part of the question is, what is their real motive? Is it to improve upon it or really just tie up the market? Do you have any comments on that?
Well, I would argue very strongly that their incentive is to tie up the market. And they're very adept at using the political institutions to do so. As I've mentioned a couple times, there's huge issues around the world about their coming penetration of other countries' markets. They've quite obviously already well penetrated ours.
Right.
And, you know, they have pretty much a monopoly share now of the seed, of all seed, whether it's genetically engineered or not.
Right, and the farmers aren't allowed to save seed if they buy their seed through their dealers, I guess. That's one of the problems.
Yep, and they sick the Pinkerton Detective Agency on the farmers who think they might be able to get away with it.
And I understand they're buying up more companies, and they should be in front of the Federal Trade Commission soon, because they, according to an article in the Progressive, they control, if they get this latest merger, 86% of cottonseed market and nearly 50% of corn and soybean markets.
That's right, and I'm afraid that the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Justice Department, will probably let them get away with it. But that is indeed well over the definition of what is a monopoly and when antitrust laws ought to kick in our law. But it's more of an administrative problem.
I wonder if you have any comment also just on the genetic studies that are going on in Iceland.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. You may know more about it than I do, actually, but what I can say is that there are peculiar genetic traits that are developed within any sort of insular group of people, and
they seem to be the most insular group of people in the world, I guess.
The Icelandics.
Right.
Well, there are a handful, a lot of tribes in the where they still survive in some of the remote tropical areas also are being targeted for genetic research as well. And it's because of their unique genetic makeup, there's, a belief, and in some cases it's been shown, that they have a particular resistance to diabetes, or they have a particular, resistance to, I'm not sure what the actual discoveries entail, but that they think then that if they take these cells from the human beings in these groups of people and work with them in the laboratory, that they could, develop, again, some medical applications. The questions there are, again, how are the benefits shared then with those peoples from whom they've taken this material, if at all? I mean, in some cases, they've done so without even letting them know. So one of the international issues is, this issue of prior informed consent, that they must be informed and asked for permission to use their material, and then likewise they should get some share of any profits that might accrue if they do develop a commercial medicine. And
the database that's being set up in Iceland, there is one corporation that has complete control over all of it, and I think what they've promised the Icelandic people is simply free medical care for the rest of their life, or something like that. But apparently this database is extraordinary because the Icelandics have always had socialized medicine, and they have records going back, medical records, personal medical records that are really kind of unprecedented of most of the Icelandic people. And then they have this, that they're so insular that they and had so many tragedies that their population is small, but yet not small as, you know, just a small tribe of people. But there is one company that has, that is setting up the database and has all rights, but it's been doing, I guess it's going through the Icelandic government, so it has been, you know, I guess they have the knowledge from it, but it still seems like a scary thing.
Yeah, do you know what the trait is that they're looking for?
Oh, it's not one specific trait that they're looking for. I don't think it's that. I think that they are just able to, well, I know they're able to study a vast number of things because of the records that are available, and that so many people are related to each other there. Practically everyone in Iceland is related, I guess. So I know that they're looking at breast cancer and different things like that. But I don't think that it's one specific thing that they've isolated. Breast cancer does come to mind, that in the article I read in the New Yorker a couple of weeks ago, that was one of the things that they were looking at.
One of these exploratory cases where they're looking for anything and they'll take whatever they find.
That's right, and they have they'll have rights to it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I look forward to hearing your talk today.
All right, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Well, let me, and I guess that we're, I don't necessarily mean to be defending capitalism, but I guess we do maybe come back to this idea that, well, okay, so let us suppose that a corporation using this kind of technology finds a cure for something that is a significant human disease. Let us say, by taking advantage of some genetic material that they would harvest from people living in the Amazon rainforest, that they could take that and they develop a cure for diabetes. Here we are balancing sort of two things. We're saying on one hand, this is great if we could cure diabetes. This is something that everybody in the world would benefit from. If the company develops the cure, and if they have exclusive rights to it for some period of time, we know that they're going to make a whole lot of money. So do we? Is that not a good trade? Do we? And if we could also build into the fact that we'll say, okay, we'll compensate the people that were the basis of the information that helped us develop this cure. We'll say, we'll take care of them in a way that would satisfy everybody. But then, so now we're going back to the idea of is it appropriate for the profit motive to drive scientific research? Isn't that okay? I mean, can't we say to that company, okay, you're going to make a bazillion bucks, but it's a good thing for everybody. So we'll say, in the end, humanity is even.
Yeah, I think that would be a good trade, all else being equal. But there is a very strong tendency when there's that gazillion bucks to be made to abuse what are common sense and just fairness issues. There's an attempt to legislate prior informed consent agreements at the international level. And what does that really mean? Does it mean talking to this person in English and saying, sign here? Or, you know, does it really mean that you're explaining what's at stake? Or what share of the profits? Should the people there get half a gazillion? Or, you know, how do you negotiate what's really a fair share of those profits? So those questions aside, I think that few people who are against the patenting of life would disagree with doing careful medical research that is very carefully monitored to do that. But the profit motive question itself, I think, is a separate discussion. And here I think the whole issue of monopolies over important research, and then if they spent a gazillion bucks, what price are they going to charge for that medicine? Is your average person with diabetes really going to be able to pay for it, or are they going to, you know, the poor people are going to die from diabetes and only those rich enough to actually buy the medicine in the medical market? Are they going to be the only ones who benefit from the result? And I've sort of talked, this is just a discussion stage, but about the way we regulate public utilities, electricity, generating power plants. In most states in the United States, they have to go before a public commission, public service commission, public utility commission, and justify their expenses, their investments in research, really show line by line whether all the money from consumers that pay their bills every month is really being put to good use. And then they have to argue for a percentage profit that they believe they should make on top of those investments. And it's a public decision. There's public debate. There are public hearings. People read about it in the paper and then might write a letter to the commissioners. And, you know, the very large public process. And it's a certain percentage on top of their actual investments. In the research of pharmaceuticals, there's no public record. There's no ceiling on how much they can profit on top of these things. And actually, there's a huge debate about whether or not the way that they direct their research is really in the public interest.
We have about 10 minutes left. And again, let me introduce our guest from the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy in Minneapolis, Kristen Dawkins. She directs the Institute's Trade and Agriculture Program. She's here to speak on these very issues as part of the Friday Forum series at a little past noon today on the U of I campus that happens at the University Y. So if you'd like to hear more from her, you can go and hear the talk. You're also welcome to call in 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next caller up is someone locally, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. There was a really interesting article that laymen like me could get insight into problems in the L.A. Times this last Sunday, which talked about the privatization of research and all the problems. They mentioned, for example, that there was this whole thing about calcium channel blockers, and it turned out that the New England Journal of Medicine discovered that virtually all the scientists who wrote journal articles supporting calcium channel blockers as a treatment for high blood pressure had a financial relationship with the manufacturers, and it hadn't been disclosed before then. And it turns out they're not that great. You were talking, I'd like to ask you a question, though, about the earlier question about whether or not people would actually make innovations, go ahead and make discoveries and innovations despite the, whether they had patents available or not. It seems pretty clear that the corporations probably wouldn't, but I was just wondering about the scientists themselves. I was reading a saying by Confucius last night, which seems really appropriate. He says, a good man takes as much trouble to discover what is right as the lesser man takes to discover what will pay. And it makes me wonder, I don't have very much faith that the corporations will ever do things like, for example, Sarah Flannery did, that 16-year-old kid in Ireland who doesn't want to take a patent out on a new way of sending email. But I'm wondering if from your knowledge of scientists and your familiarity with them, do you feel that as a group they've turned kind of mercenary over the years? Is there any indication that they're protesting the way their industry is being kind of distorted by commercialization? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, I think there is a growing concern among the scientific community about this this trend here. Certainly there are plenty of them who hope, if not to get some financial rewards, because most often the patent is held by the company or the university and not by the individuals, and they're simply on a payroll, probably fairly well paid. But nonetheless, it's the squelching of the research, I think, that is of more concern to them. And you hear more of it all the time. I think it's a growing concern, and you'd probably find a lot of scientists on both sides nowadays. But I believe this concern won't go away. We'll see more and more of it in the next few years.
It seems that if we want to make the argument that there are positive benefits to having this kind of research done in the public sector, then I think we know that's going to have to be funded by the government, probably by the federal government. And it seems that that is something that we are less and less willing to do, or maybe it's political leadership of the country is less and less willing to do, say, yes, funding scientific research is a good thing. We think that's a legitimate place for public money to go. And it seems as that a lot of that has been ceded to private industry, that we're just not saying that it's that as a nation, scientific research is something that we think is important.
Sure, I think that's right. But I also think it's because the public really isn't that aware of some of these issues. What we're exposed to in the sort of regular media simply isn't informative enough about the subtleties of these debates. I think we find more and more, though, that people are becoming concerned, and you know, that we'll see how that shows up in terms of, talk taxes in this country and you're immediately in trouble. So I don't know what to say about that. But even our government researchers, I'm sorry to say, are at least at the moment kind of in the loop of really looking for the big, big payoff and very much beholden to the corporations. There's a revolving door going on between the Monsanto Company and any number of other major corporations in this field, pharmaceutical sector and agribusiness, that is having huge influence. For example, I believe the person who, for the Federal Drug Administration, wrote the text for the label that for the genetically engineered milk, RBGH milk, with the bovine growth hormone in it, the person who wrote the label that the feds require, even those dairies that say they'd like to say our milk is RBGH free, aren't allowed to do so by federal law. They have to use this complete text that was written by this FDA guy that's long and full of jargon and hard to understand for the average consumer. And it says there's no real difference between the milk from cows treated with RBGH and those not treated with RBGH. Well, there's new scientific evidence showing that that's not even true, that there are indeed some serious health risks. The Canadians just banned RBGH a week or two ago for the reason that they've discovered a rat study that was suppressed, again, a Monsanto rat study, their government suppressed in order to get RBGH into the market up there, and now they've banned it once the study came out and it was leaked. But back to my story about the FDA guy who wrote this convoluted language for the RBGH label in the United States. He, it turns out, had formerly worked for a law firm in Atlanta that had Monsanto as its client, and he was the lawyer who held the Monsanto account.
Hmm. Let's go on. We'll take another caller here locally, line number two. Hello.
Hi. Say, we've done a little bit of work in the pharmaceutical industry, and we've got a pretty good picture of what it costs to bring these products to market. I was just wondering, do you keep track of what these costs are?
Yeah, my own institute mostly deals with the ag sector, and so we haven't ourselves, but I would refer you to part of Ralph Nader's Public Citizen Project in Washington, D.C., which has been working for years on strictly the question of patented pharmaceuticals relative to generic pharmaceuticals. And they have a very well-documented study showing that the alleged costs in the private sector to develop a commercial drug are vastly inflated. So I would refer you again to Ralph Nader's outfit.
We've been involved in the production of two new antibiotics
mm-hmm.
and bringing them to market. And one of the problems that I see is the conflicting barriers that are put up by the regulating agencies. Once a drug has a NDA approved, it's literally an act of Congress. If you go back and the drug is put into production, and maybe it would have up to 200 steps to make this pharmaceutical. If you go back and you find a better way to do it, it's not possible to change your process without having a new NDA issued. And we were involved in one circumstance where the EPA authorities demanded that a step be changed, and the FDA countered it and said, no, you can't do it. And so I think people, it is very difficult to make these drugs, to make sure that they're pure. The capital cost is tremendous in these plants, and you have to see it firsthand before you say that it's not. And they do produce a very, very good product, and it's done at a reasonable cost. And the other thing is, it's we should all be thankful that we have these drugs available and that someone's working on them. I think you have to be careful when you see one-sided information, and before you walk through one of these plants. They're modern wonders. They're highly regulated. They provide very good jobs, and the technology, it is a modern wonder of the world, and it's real expensive to do it. I've seen it firsthand. So I'd like for you to comment on that, and we've seen it, and I'll tell you what, it's expensive business. Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Sure, thanks for the call. Whatever comment you'd want to make?
Well, sure. I definitely would not want to detract from all those dedicated researchers out there who are really doing their best to help humanity. I would agree that it's very expensive, and the numbers Ralph Nader's office uses, whether they're talking about the inflated numbers or the numbers that they've been able to document, both of those sets of numbers are just huge. So I would agree that we need to be investing in this kind of research. It's just a question of how much money is wasted and how much profit is taken on top of actual investments, and how that is being monitored by the public sector.
Well, we are going to have to stop right here because we're here at the end of the time, but I'm sure that on future programs we'll get back to some of these issues. And, of course, as we continue to follow along the Friday Forum series, we'll talk about various dimensions of this issue of empowering the human in the technological society. But, again, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Kristen Dawkins, from the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy in Minneapolis, she'll be speaking on this topic, the ownership of life when patents and values clash, as part of the Friday Forum series. It's the first speech in this spring series. It takes place a little bit past noon at the University Y, 1001 South Wright on the U of I campus. And anybody who would like to attend is welcome. Thank you for talking with us.
Well, thank you, and thanks to the callers, too.